Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, thank you for joining us again at New Books Network. Today, we have Anne Murphy, who is Professor of History and Executive Dean of the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences at the University of Portsmouth. Previous to that, she had been at the University of Hertfordshire and at the School of Social Sciences at the University of Exeter. Before coming to academic life, she was for 12 years working as a city trader in foreign exchange and derivatives. Her research focuses on early modern financial markets and investment behavior and the organization of management in 18th century Bank of England. Her latest publication on the topic of today's chat is Virtuous Bankers, A Day in the Life of the 18th Century Bank of England, published by Princeton University Press this year. Anne Murphy, thank you very much for being with us in New Books Network.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's lovely to be here.
How is it that you decided to move from being a derivatives trader to become an academic, and particularly an academic in financial history?
So I left banking in 1997. It was just about the time when the euro was taking over. Before that, I traded a lot of European currencies. So my job, if you like, was coming to an end or about to change quite significantly. So I took the decision to make a new start. I have to say also that while banking was really, really exciting when I was in my 20s and sort of coming out of school and going into the city of the 1980s, just post Big Bang, and when so many changes were happening, so much being developed and really, really interesting changes to the way that we managed finance at that time. By the time it got to the later 90s, I think I felt I'd seen most of it, that I was not feeling very stimulated by the environment. It didn't feel like it was intellectually stretching. So I took the decision that I was going to quit and go to university instead. I had no clue what I wanted to do at all. All I knew was that I didn't want to be in investment banking until retirement. So I needed to make another choice. But university was entirely about giving myself 3 years to think about it and think about what to do next.
Right. And then how you've dedicated the book to the late Bill Cottrell. A friend of both of ours and a very respected, not only a good friend, but a highly respected scholar. So how did you meet Phil and why did you wanted to dedicate the book to him?
So as I said, I went to university. I went to University of Leicester and I didn't really know what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, but I studied history and politics. And one day going up, the University of Leicester's history department is in the Attenborough Tower, for those of you who know Leicester, and it has a Paternoster lift. So it's an open lift and it goes up and down the floors. And you can see out of it, you're used to be able to see the notice boards of all the different departments as you go up and down. And one day I noticed an advertisement for an MA in International Economic History and decided, okay, well, I'm coming towards the end of my degree. That sounds like something that I want to do. And I'd figured out that I liked university and I wanted to stay. So I wandered down to Phil's office and kind of introduced myself and said, this is what I want to do. And he was, you know, he was so welcoming and he was, you know, he was so interesting and just such an impressive scholar. He would come in. So I did study this MA and Phil taught on it and he would come into the room with no notes whatsoever. And he would, you know, he'd talk for hours about almost anything, and just incredibly knowledgeable. So I think Phil, I hope Phil and I became friends kind of over that period and over the period when I was doing my PhD. He wasn't my PhD supervisor, but he was a mentor throughout. And then when I had a postdoc at Leicester, he was my mentor then. And then in the first few years of my career, whenever there was a problem, whenever there was something that I really needed to talk about and think about, it would be Phil that I would go to. So this book took a long time to write. So a lot of the early conversations about this book and the kind of sources that I was working with and what I could do with them and what they might tell us about banking, those conversations were conversations I had with Phil. So I wanted to honor that, but I also wanted to honor what a wonderful, innovative, interesting scholar of banking history Phil was. And I really do, you know, I meant the dedication. I really do hope he would have approved for what the book turned out to be.
In normal circumstances, I would have stopped the interview here because it's such a great book that I can only praise the great effort that you have done. And I do hope and I sincerely think that Phil would have approved. But let's allow others to have a peek of this work. Very detailed, very conscientious, and excellently, you know, written in such a nice prose that invites, you know, you just cannot put it aside. So congratulations on that. And before we go into discussing the book itself, what sort of advice would you have to early career scholars that are thinking of publishing a book? You know, is it a good idea? How to go about it? How to choose a publisher?
So thank you for your kind words. I really do appreciate that. And I'm glad you enjoyed the book. I think for early career scholars, I think particularly those who want to find work in history departments, having that monograph is an invaluable part of their CV. Slightly different if you're thinking about going into an economics department or into a business school. But I would say also that most people, having worked on their dissertation, they have something to say in monograph form, and they should certainly consider whether it's appropriate to say that. But I think also remember that books, they have to sell. So they have to have a broader appeal than a standard dissertation. They have to have a market that they can reach out to. And I think there are kind of two ways of thinking about that market. Either you have a scholarly market plus perhaps a wider audience. And that's certainly what I was trying to do with this book. I was trying to connect both with a scholarly market who I hope will be engaged with various themes in the book. But I was sort of trying to reach out to a wider audience as well, an audience that I know is out there. I guess of people like me who are kind of ex-financiers who still remain interested in the world of finance. And also, you know, we know how popular history is as a subject. In other contexts, though, I think if you're thinking about a more narrow scholarly audience, you've got to think about how you appeal not just to your immediate peers, but to other scholars who might be interested. So I think it's about making sure that you contextualize your work really well within broad literatures. Tell the readership what it is that they should gain from this, how they might understand it, how it might reach out to speak to the work that they want to do. So, for example, I try in my work not only to reach out to economic historians, but to say something to social and cultural historians about the value of thinking about finance in their work and about the value of understanding the financial atmosphere, the financial milieu of the 18th century as part of everyday life, as part of cultural life, as part of life that is expressed in art and in literature. And I think those sorts of things are really important as well. I would say also to anybody thinking about writing a book is that it can be really hard work writing a monograph. This one took me a long time. So do think about timeliness, think about getting it done. It needs to be finished. It's never going to be perfect. So every time you go back to the work that you do, you kind of spot different things and more things that could have gone into it. So it'll never be perfect, but it needs to be finished. And then I would also say, be really mindful of what a publisher will do for you and won't do for you. I cannot praise Princeton highly enough for the way that they have supported this book and the way that they have supported me throughout the book, and also the way that they pushed me to get it finished, because it was definitely Princeton who were pushing in that last sort of year to 6 months to have the book finished. Other publishers perhaps won't do that sort of thing in quite that way, or that you might not have a book that will sort of connect with audiences in quite that way. So think about how you will do it. Think about how you might use your social media and your networks and your contacts to make sure that you leverage the work that you've done so that it finds a wide audience. There's no point in writing something that only three people are ever going to read. You want your work to be out there. You want it to be read. And then I suppose that my last bit of advice, which is a bit of advice for everybody who's not already joined, but join ALCS, the Authors Licensing and Copyright Society, I think, because they collect royalties for you, and you find yourself at the end of each year with a very nice check that comes back from that. So it's definitely worthwhile doing. It's definitely worthwhile getting access to those royalties.
Thank you. For that and for that introduction to our early career researchers. So let's move on to the book itself. There are two things that stand out, or that I think that bring the book together, you tell me. But one of them is the inspector's report, and you can tell the audience a little bit more of what this is and the importance and how it came about. Secondly, your but the way that you've structured the book is, as the title says, the day in the life of the bank. So you are taking one period during the day, so it's not minute by minute, it's not around an individual, but it's around processes and around activities that are happening in the bank throughout the day, but probably in some instances they are either intensified or only take place at one point in the day. And through this, then we go into, or you go into, other things. So let's go back then and tell us about how you found out this inspector's report, what is the importance of this report, and how, with on the basis of this report, you are able to contribute to the overall discussion of late 18th century finance.
So I discovered the inspector's reports when I was doing my postdoc. So it would have been sort of 2007-ish. And it was just one of those lucky things. I'd gone through I suppose I'd recommend everybody to do J.H. Clapham's Old History of the Bank, which was written in the 1940s. And I looked at the sources that he mentioned, things that I hadn't looked at while I was doing my PhD. And I called these up in the archive, and Clapham had just sort of dismissed them, really. He just said something like, they're matters of purely internal concern. So I just called them up to have a quick look at them, thinking I'd have a look and I'd send them back. There wouldn't be anything interesting. But once I got into them, what I discovered was that here was a complete description of everything that happened in the bank, along with all these really sort of nice little vignettes of individuals and processes and things that were being done, concerns that the inspectors had. And that sort of that kind of suggested to me that there was something there to explore in more depth. I didn't do much more at that time, but you know, I knew it was something that I wanted to come back to.
Sorry to interrupt you, but probably we want to clarify or contextualize that the inspector's report is put together by three of the directors when the bank is about 90 years old. So the bank had been going on, it had become part of the industrial network, of the financial market. It was playing certain very important role as a bank of the state, and you explained to what extent it is really a bank of the state. It still remains a private entity, and it's at this point that this report is being commissioned as a way to look at into the working of the bank, correct?
That's right, yes. So these three directors spend an entire year going around the bank from March 1783 to March 1784. It's a period of crisis, so it's the end of the War of American Independence, and I think they're definitely doing this to kind of fend off interest from the state in what they're doing, and whether they're doing this work well, how corrupt the bank is or isn't, whether there are lots of questions about whether the bank should not necessarily be replaced, because I think that would have been impossible by that time, but whether there should be the capacity to set up rival institutions that might take away some of the bank's business. So they are very definitely trying to assert the virtue and value of the bank through the work that they do. But within that, they do all sorts of other really interesting things. And you asked me about the way that I came to sort of the idea of a day in the life. And it was quite odd, actually, because I must have read the minutes probably three or four times before it occurred to me that it was littered with references to time. So all throughout the day, they're saying, we do this. This is the cutoff time is noon. It takes us about 20 minutes to do this. People are leaving at 3 o'clock. Our lunch break is between 1:30 and 3 o'clock. So the sort of references to time are absolutely everywhere. And I sort of started off an exploration of that and wrote an article about time, which I hope kind of connected with the E.P. Thompson arguments about time and work. But it also suggested to me at that point that if you wanted to, you could write a day in the life. But I also kept dismissing it. So I kept thinking, yes, I could do that. But that isn't that just a mad idea when what you want to do is to tell the story of an institution and how it works? And isn't it a mad idea because so much happens in the morning and then there's a sort of hiatus in the afternoon? So how are you going to get past that? And I remember having this really great conversation with David Kynaston when he was writing his book about the Bank of England. And I said to him, oh, I thought I could do this. I thought I could write a day in the life. And he said to me, oh, definitely, you should definitely do that. And at that point, the idea kind of crystallized and I decided that I could, right up until I think about half a dozen times through the writing process when I was really pulling my hair out. And as you said, you know, there are times when it's very much being driven by what's going on at that particular time. But you have to fit in things like management, and you have to talk about occupational health, And you have to talk about the Gordon riots because they're, you know, they're sort of pivotal to, and you have to talk about what the building looks like. So where do you fit all of those things in? All the things that kind of happen across the day, within the day. And those were the bits that drove me crazy during the writing period.
Thank you. Well, yeah, and how did you went about and collected other evidence, and what type of other evidence were you collecting to be able to patch up? Because the directors are talking to themselves. They are writing in 18th century format, of course, which is, I mean, we can read it, but it's of course different. Mm-hmm. Yes, to be able, I mean, there are some bits that you can get from what other people have done, but how do you go about and you know, collect this other material, and what other material are you trying to bring in to complement or actually to build the story up?
So I think scholars of the Bank of England are very lucky because the bank has been very good about maintaining its records and keeping its records. It's kept lots and lots of things. So there's lots of stuff in the bank. So things like salary records and records of sort of nascent interviews that they do with men coming in to jobs at the bank. There are stock ledgers, there are transfer books, there are the general ledgers. So all of those sorts of things are there and you can look at them. And I think what I perhaps needed to be reminded of was their value as sources, but also their value as objects. So to think about them and to think about what the bank looked like and felt like and smelt like, and how it was experienced by individuals. The bank's museum is really good for that as well. So the bank's museum is kind of set out in ways that allow you a little bit to experience what it might have been like in the 18th and 19th century. So that was really useful. You can look at the trunks and the ways that the banknotes looked. There are also lots of images that are available, both in caricature form, but also in representations of the individuals and the spaces within the bank. So I tried to use those to get a sense of what it might have looked like and what it might have felt like. Plans of the bank. There's a great book by Daniel Abramson on the architecture of the bank, which was incredibly useful to me, thinking about not only the way that the bank was built and constructed, but also how it sat within its landscape. And then I drew on all sorts of other sources from the 18th century. So things like information about fire engines and night watchmen, what £50 per year, which was the starting wage, would have meant to individuals, all those sorts of things I found out from pamphlet literature at the time. And then I hope I tried to sort of read quite widely from colleagues' work around not only what the banking environment was, but also the physical landscape, the ways that people interacted. So I used, for example, literature on shopping to try and think about what the experience of being in those public spaces might be. So how people would have negotiated the banking hall, for example, those sorts of things.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the structure, which is split into six chapters, and how the themes come together, and how, as this day is progressing, you're touching on the different activities. So if you want to walk us through the six chapters from opening the gates to guardian of public credit, please.
So starts when the gates open in the morning. So 6 o'clock in the morning in the summer, 7 o'clock in the morning in the winter. With that sort of opening chapter, I look at the architecture of the bank, what it would have looked like for those clerks who were working there. But also I look at how the bank was set up for the day and how that kind of interconnected with a polite society and a kind of sense of the bank's customer base as being one that didn't need to be assailed with the dirt and the bustle of city streets. You know, the bank needed to be kept clean. It needed to be kept as a space that catered to a genteel clientele. Then the following chapter is all about the process of banking, really. So the issuance of banknotes, discounting of bills of exchange, extension of credit. And a lot of that business went on in the morning because that was when business owners, merchants were around and kind of doing their business, their walks through London, their connections with colleagues, people who they would have been working with. And they would have visited the bank first thing in the morning. The bank also had a midday cutoff point for those sorts of transactions. So that meant that they had to be done in the morning as well. I suppose what I found really interesting there was the management of discounting bills of exchange, particularly in the way that credit decisions were made. And there's some interesting things to say about whether it was the basis of kind of personal credit or more impersonal credit at the end of the 18th century. And I think it's a bit of a mix of both. By 11 o'clock, we sort of move on to the next chapter, which is the brokers and the jobbers coming to the bank, and the market in the state's debt and the bank shares opening up. There's a space in the 18th century bank where the market gathers, and it's an open outcry market with all of the kind of disruption and noise that brings. I think the banking hall itself is quite a genteel space. The brokers exchange where the market is gathering is much less so. It's much more of a noisy, disrupted and disruptive space, a more risky space, a space where, you know, you might be assailed by pickpockets or street sellers or prostitutes or, you know, all of those sorts of people could have made it into that particular space. There's a lot there to say about just the process of managing the state's debt and the way that the bank managed that so as to inculcate a sense of trust between the people who were lending the state money and the state itself. I think it's very clear that the bank stood as a mediator between those two parties and created a sense of trust for the two. By about 1 o'clock, the rhythm of the bank is really changed quite significantly, and the rhythm of the city is changing as well. So lunchtime, what we would call lunchtime, sort of dinner time in the 18th century, is about sort of 2 o'clock onwards. So people are stopping the work that they do. They're taking time out in taverns or coffee houses or chop houses to sort of sit down and eat. You're very much on a kind of social basis. I'm sure business was still done there, but it's business in social spaces rather than business in office spaces. And this was one of my sticking points when I was writing the book. So for a long time, that chapter had about 1,000 words in it of the clerks went off to lunch and here is where they had their lunch. And eventually I figured out I could use that chapter to explain what was happening in the mid-afternoon when the senior men were all leaving the bank. So they left about 3:30 and they left it in the hands of the more junior men. So I use that chapter really to talk about hierarchies, to talk about the way that men worked their way up from an initial entry period into the bank and then how they rose to high office. I talk about levels of subordination and who was in charge of who paid attention to who. And I also kind of use that to talk about what the incentives were to act well in the interests of the bank. By the time you get into the later afternoon, again, the sort of the process of the public within the bank has really wound down. So chapter 5 is about the accounting processes. And there are lots of these. And I found it really fascinating that what we're talking about is an institution that is trying to live update so that the ledgers are ready for the next day. But all with ledgers and quill and pen. So the sort of work that kind of happens automatically now with a kind of update, a computer update overnight, they were doing that in the evening, updating the key ledgers, making sure that they were ready for the next day. And that process of accounting really is a process of demonstrating accountability as well. So notaries come into the bank at 5 o'clock and they expect to see some of the ledgers updated. People can see those ledgers, they can ask for them. And therefore, the very process of keeping the ledgers and keeping them well had to be done and had to be seen to be done. There's also an element in that chapter about the occupational health of clerks who were spending their entire day sitting hunched over ledgers and not really moving. So their eyesight is poor. They've got repetitive strain injury. They've got digestive problems because they sat hunched over their desks all day, probably much like typical academics today, perhaps. And then in the evening, there's a long process of sort of locking up. The bank is very active in the evening because the people who are maintaining the accounts are still there. But it's also at risk in the evening. So it's at risk from riot, which is, I suppose, one of the things that we would automatically associate, particularly with the Gordon riots and the Gordon rioters having attacked the bank. But actually, the real risks are keys left lying around. And there are very, very many of those. And the risk of fire, the risk of almost a domestic fire. So candles left unattended to. There are residential spaces within the bank as well that might cause fires. So the maintenance of that kind of watchfulness to protect the bank is really important. But also what the bank is doing to protect itself against fire. So having its own fire engines, maintaining its own water supply, sending some records out of the bank at the end of every day, putting all of the key ledgers in wheeled trucks so that if there is a fire, they can be wheeled out of the bank really quickly. I found those processes of just that sort of sense of thought about how you protect yourselves in the 18th century against those risks when the ledgers contain really, you know, a good sort of two-thirds to three-quarters of the record of the national debt, which would have been irreplaceable had it gone up in smoke.
You've mentioned, what I was going to ask next, which is how we can see at this point in time, in what is already a large organization, because it's employing over 300 people, and it's by that measure, it's bigger than many other organizations of the time, and is able to do all of these processes in ways that we would recognize today, but that we also can see or makes us think about how they have evolved. You've mentioned, for example, that the market actually takes place. I mean, it's face to face and it's taking part in the courtyard of the bank. But today we would think that that's the only place where it's happening, but it's not. It's actually some of these activities are taking place throughout the city, throughout the financial district, and then they appear or they come together in at the bank. You also let me illustrate this with chapter two of Polite Banking. I think that you've opened up a number of discussions that need to be, if not reassessed, certainly considered deeply. I mean, I was just, this discussion between different ways in which money comes about, and there are two schools, the more economics oriented, and then the cartelist or state theory of money, and they're having a big discussion between them. And here you are somewhere in the middle of this. There has in the sense of a number of colleagues coming out with books looking at the US and how the roots of the US financial system roughly take place around this time in 1790 in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And we leave that discussion aside for the moment. But here you're showing what is happening in the UK, which is the metropolis, and you could see arguments that could go to either one of these two schools of thought. There is private money, which is one of the things that Lawrence Klein and George Selging and these type of people have argued, which is describing, without going into all of the details, with elements of the state theory of money, but it's not really state imposed because it's not, I mean, legal tender is years away. You can pay taxes, but it's not necessarily, you know, the state itself lacks credence. You mentioned how the debt of the British state was still being questioned as to whether it was going to be paid. So therefore, the way that you're going to redeem that debt, which eventually we would call cash, yes, it's still questionable. I mean, it's not that clear that you're gonna accept it. But more to that, where one of the things that I found fascinating in the book is how you are able to take a breathing space or take a space within this discussion and relate, as you said, in trying to bring these other discussions in. It's very seldom, or I cannot recall now, a discussion in financial history that takes a space to discuss what are the haptics, you know, what are the senses, what are the smells, what are the sights, and how is that affecting the overall working? Because of course you tell a little bit of that and the way that paper money works and are making this effort, as you said a moment ago, to bring social and cultural historians and see that there is something for them to contribute and to say about finance. I don't know if you want to elaborate a little bit more on this very long question.
Sure, yeah. I think for a long time, I think I was very resistant to the idea that paper money, that the Bank of England's notes was part of the financial revolution. You know, I suppose my financial revolution was kind of the financial revolution of Dixon, which was very much about public debt and the way that public debt was managed. And I was persuaded by Christine Desand's work to think about banknotes and the way they were used as part of the financial revolution and therefore part of the establishment of trust between individuals and the state. And the reason she sort of locates banknotes as part of the financial revolution is that she talks about them as being accepted for the payment of taxation. Therefore, they become intimately linked with the process of public credit. And it's another intimate link between the bank and the state. It's the state saying, here is our trusted broker, here is our trusted contractor. And I do think thinking about the bank as one of the state's contractors in this space is really important as well. And so that's the way that I was thinking about money, and therefore trying to use that chapter to look at the way that money was being processed and the way that the bank was extending credit and using its notes to become part of the credibility of public credit. And sort of tying this in with, you know, why am I interested in haptics and smell, and why am I interested in the idea that the banking hall is a polite space, you know, is a space where the kind of sociability of finance is happening. And that's because I was really interested in thinking about how we understand, or how an 18th century actor could understand the creditworthiness of the state, and what the work of people like Craig Muldrew and Margot Finn tell us is that people were very used to assessing the credibility of individuals. And they did that in a whole variety of ways. They certainly did it by looking at their accounts, you know, by looking at their sort of paper-based behavior, by looking at the way that they acted within financial spaces. But they also looked at their broader behavior. They looked at the way that they dressed. They looked at the way, who they interacted with, who they were connected with. So one of the things that I'm really interested in is thinking about how do we understand the state in those terms? What if you want to think of the state as an individual, what would you look at? What would you see? What would you observe that demonstrated their creditworthiness? And I think the Bank of England is the site where 18th century actors could go to see, you know, to physically experience the state's creditworthiness and credibility. And those sort of haptics, the way that the bank looked, the way that it constructed itself as not ostentatious, but an impressive building, the way that it used certain symbols like Britannia or the statue of William III to create that sort of connection with the state. And also the way then, on a much more sort of prosaic level, that you then touch, feel, smell, sense, experience, just the process of exchanging a note or taking a note or buying and selling the debt and seeing the paper on which that was recorded and being able to touch the paper on which that was recorded. And learning, I suppose, what we learn. I mean, we don't use notes anymore, do we? Kind of COVID paid to that. But if we think about when we use notes on a very regular basis, you wouldn't necessarily have looked at them. You touched them in your hand and you knew they felt like notes because the paper felt different to anything else. But when you did look at them, there were certain, you know, there's certain keys that you look for. You know, you look for the little Britannia, little foil Britannia. You look for the watermark. You look for the foil strip that goes through it. So what were people in the 18th century looking for when they were doing that sort of thing? I hope that answered your question.
Yes, it does. Thank you. How, my next to last question would be, how would you avoid, or given the number of similarities that you see with today's management and organization and financial markets, how would you avoid this idea of presentism, this idea of imposing today's view, criticisms, into a different reality?
And I think that's a really interesting question. And it's one that's come up quite a bit already. So in social media interactions with what do you mean virtuous bankers? You know, that there are no such thing as virtuous bankers. So you know that's an oxymoron. What are you talking about? So I hope that I do avoid presentism. I think there are sort of rhymes in history, aren't they? I don't think necessarily history repeats itself, but it does rhyme. And there is much to be said, I think, for understanding the way that banking works with a sense of understanding the way that these things work today. I don't think, had I not worked in financial markets, and in open outcry markets, I don't think I would have thought of them in the same way. I don't think I would have thought of sound. I don't think I would have thought of movement. I don't think I would have thought of the way that you feel excited or you feel anxious within those spaces in quite the same way as I do. So I hope those sorts of kind of modern experiences are something valuable to bring to an understanding of the 18th century. But then I do also think we have got to, we've got to put ourselves to, you know, to the stress of understanding that this is an environment in which paper is still asserting itself. It is still trusted by some, but not trusted by others. That this is still an environment where there is so much to do in order to maintain credibility. That this is still an environment where bankers can be convinced of the virtue and the public good of what they are doing, despite evidence of corruption or despite evidence of fee taking or gratuities, or despite evidence of embezzlement, that the public good can be easily and really assertively maintained by the directors who are doing this inspection. And I do think thinking about how that comes about in an 18th century environment is very important.
Women receive some attention, primarily as bank customers. Mm-hmm. Would they be able to play another role? Probably it's a tricky question, really. What I'm trying really to ask is there a gendered story of the Bank of England that needs to be written?
Yes, but I suspect it's been written. So Amy Freud's book, Silent Partners, I think is a really good starting point for that. Had I written it a different way, had I had sort of more space or more time, if I had potentially another project in me right now, which I'm not sure that I do, but I think trying to get to the bottom of who were those women who were acting as brokers and jobbers in the market, and how their work happened, and how they managed to assert themselves, is definitely an important story to tell. Understanding better the extent to which women as business owners used the bank, I think is really important as well. And I think that story is there in the ledgers to be explored. So for anybody who's interested, I have a list of projects that could be done around this, but that's definitely one of them.
Well, thank you very much, Anne Murphy, for your time. It's always a pleasure talking to you, and especially around this great project. I do hope that when you finish your administrative responsibilities, you find time to engage in another project, and we have time to talk about it on the fringes and as well as here on the podcast.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time, and it's been lovely talking about the book.
Well, this is all for us today. Please, if you are not a subscriber, subscribe to New Books Network. And if you are a subscriber, do leave us a note or rank us. That always helps and sends a very positive message and help us spread the word. That's all from me today. This is Bernardo Batislazo, and we've been talking to Anne Murphy on her book, Virtuous Bankers, A Day in the Life of the 18th Century Bank of England, published by Princeton University Press in 2023.